Coming up is the news.
Stories this hour, Europe gradually feels the pinch of Russian energy bans, with most Germans reducing energy use while Britain turning to old coal-fired power units. Iran reiterates that the 2015 deal can be revived once Tehran's red lines are respected and it is able to reap full economic benefits of the accord. The Israeli military raids the offices of Palestinian human rights groups in the occupied West Bank as the regime intensifies its crackdown. Thank you for joining us. A top story this hour, a new survey shows 7 out of 10 Germans are using less energy amid a surge in costs due to high inflation in Europe's largest economy. The survey by a Berlin-based research group Infratrust DMAP shows those using less energy is up from 63% in April. A 35% rise in energy costs in the second quarter pushed Germany's inflation to 8.5%. The country is facing an energy crunch due to decreased gas supplies from Russia. Moscow cites technical reasons, but Berlin calls it politically motivated. The energy regulator says gas reserves will only be enough to run heating and industrial facilities for over 2 months if Russia completely halts supplies. That has prompted Germany to stockpile gas and accelerate its transition to green energies. Chancellor Olaf Scholz is expected to sign a deal to establish hydrogen supply chains with Canada during his upcoming trip. Scholz will also discuss the prospects of Canadian LNG deliveries to Germany. Energy-hungry Britain is now turning to old coal-fired power units as last resort to deal with shortages in the coming winter. The National Grid's electricity system operator ESO says the move is to ensure supplies in case other sources fail to provide enough electricity. The National Grid says it has signed contracts with power generators, Drax Group and EDF to extend the life of 4 coal-fired power units which were either closed or on the verge of closure. The ESO also says that the available capacity will only be used when all commercial options are exhausted within balancing mechanism. The upfront cost is expected to be between £220 and £420 million and the units will be available until the end of March 2023. Britain, along with many European countries, is facing an energy crisis as a result of Russia cutting off its supplies. A fresh round of rail strikes has gotten underway across the UK, bringing the travel chaos to millions of travellers for the next 3 days. The move comes after long-running negotiations between trade unions and the government over pay and working conditions failed to produce an agreement. Saidpour Reza has more in this report.
Another mass walkout bringing the UK's railway network to a grinding halt, causing major disruptions. Tens of thousands of signalers, maintenance workers, ticket collectors fighting for their rights as negotiations with the government for better pay and conditions hit the buffers.
I support the workers that are striking.
We're being inconvenienced, but they're being treated unequally.
Many rail employees, often working unsocial hours in a high-pressure environment, say they have seen no pay rise in 3 years. As the specter of soaring inflation, predicted to surpass 13% over the next year, looms over negotiations. The Conservative government has offered a below-inflation pay rise and accuses the unions organizing the strikes of taking the country for ransom. Despite that, public support for the strikes is on the rise.
I'm quite sympathetic to the train strikes. Actually, the other the other industrial unrest, because it comes on the back of minimal increase in wages over a long period of time, a pay freeze much more recently, and an offer which is frankly way, way, way below the current rate of inflation.
Stoking the public ire, comments by Conservative Prime Ministerial hopeful Liz Truss, who has pledged to restrict the ability of public sector workers to strike.
Liz Truss is seeking to take away human rights and the ability of the democratic right of people to express themselves through their trade unions and industrial action, which is one of the pillars of our democracy. It's only repressive regimes that stop people going on strike and stop them expressing themselves and stop them rebalancing the power in the workplace through their trade unions.
The opposition Labour Party, which receives funding from several trade unions itself, has also come under fire for failing to support the walkouts. The rail strikes, which also include London's underground and overground network, have set off a wave of industrial action that is set to get bigger, with teachers, health workers, and even barristers planning their own strikes.
Britain's so-called summer of discontent seems well underway, with a general strike more likely now than ever before, and with the railway workers in the eye of the storm. Saeed Purezap, London.
Iran's foreign minister has reiterated that the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA hinges on respecting the Islamic Republic's red lines. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment in a phone call with his Omani counterpart, Badr al-Busaidi. The top Iranian diplomat said Tehran must also be able to reap the full economic benefits of a revived agreement. Earlier this week, Iran provided the EU with its final conclusion on talks aimed at salvaging the pact. Iran says it is now Washington's turn to show flexibility and take a realistic approach if it really wants a final agreement. The US sent the deal into limbo after unilaterally pulling out of it in 2018 and reimposing sanctions on Iran. Talks have been held among the remaining signatories since April last year to rescue the accord. History professor David Yaghoubian says it's Iran's right to get assurances that it can reap full economic benefits of the JCPOA. Let's listen.
The ball is truly in the court of the United States now, and it does seem as though we have arrived at a point where the remaining issues relative to the what now 16 months of negotiations seem to be very close to being resolved. And so I think the real hang-up is the necessity for Iran to acquire assurances that it can indeed benefit economically from a return by the United States to the agreement, and as well that there must be some hook, some punishment for the United States if once again it decides to unilaterally pull out of the agreement and to basically break international law. I do believe that if the Biden administration can, at the very least, and I think this is critical, make the promise to stay in the agreement, to live up to its obligations, that this will still, considering the weakness internally within the American political system related to sustaining international agreements and international law, I feel like this is possibly, unfortunately, the best that the Biden administration can do.
Israel releases footage of its forces raiding the offices of Palestinian human rights groups in the occupied West Bank. The military says it's closed seven institutions and confiscated property during the overnight raids. Senior Palestinian Authority official Hossein al-Sheikh censured the raids as an attempt to silence the voice of the truth and justice. The European Union has declared support for the Palestinian NGOs, calling Tel Aviv's allegations against those organizations unsubstantiated. Israel has labeled six Palestinian rights groups, quote, as terrorist organizations. Without providing evidence for its allegations, the regime recently passed into law the terror designation of three of those rights groups. Last month, nine member states of the European Union issued a joint statement saying they would continue to cooperate with those six groups. Bruce Katz is the co-president of the Palestinian and Jewish Unity based in Montreal. He joined us a short while ago to tell us more about the Israeli crackdown on Palestinian NGOs.
Essentially, when I look at what they've been doing and tried to do to these human rights groups, what I see here is the very same type of crackdown that the South African apartheid regime attempted to do with human rights groups and political groups in South Africa. And they failed. Israel will fail as well, because it's as the European Union has stated. This is unsubstantiated. It's quite simply invented, with the objective of attempting to silence a legitimate criticism of what is a racist and exceptionally brutal apartheid regime in Tel Aviv.
The Malian foreign minister has accused France of supporting terrorist groups in his country. We discussed the matter in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the Malian foreign minister accuses France of supporting terrorist groups in his country, where Paris maintained a military presence until just a few days ago. In a letter to the UN Security Council, the minister called for an urgent meeting in order for Bamako to present evidence. It says French fighter jets, drones, and military helicopters breached Mali's airspace more than 50 times this year. The letter also says that those flagrant violations were used by France to collect intelligence for terrorist groups operating in the Sahel region and to drop arms and ammunition for them. France has rejected the allegations, which comes just days after it announced the final withdrawal of forces from Mali. France deployed troops to its former colony under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but many Malians consider the mission a failure. To discuss that further, we are joined by Mustapha Traoré, academic and political commentator, who's joining us live from Paris, and also Geroid O'Colmain, a journalist and political analyst, also joining us from Paris. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us. Let's begin with Mr. Traoré, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. First of all, why did France need a military presence in Mali in the first place? What was the excuse back then?
Yes, it was a fake excuse. First, what the Malians asked, they asked for the help of the French. That was in 2013, but they were asking for information help, which means aircraft. So they did not ask for the French military to come on foot on the Malian soil, but France decided to come. So this is the first thing, and no one knows about this one. Only the Malians know about what they asked for. If you check the official documents, when the person who was in power at the time, his name was Jean Kounda Traoré, what he did, he called the French president, who was Hollande at the time. He said, okay, could you support us with aircraft so that we can better fight against the terrorists and those who wanted to split the country into two countries. So it was a fake excuse that France used. So this is the first issue Malians have with the French. The second one they have is that once the north was liberated, the Malian army was forbidden to go in the city of Kidal, which is in the north. So only the French and the people from the north were there, and they were committing crimes, attacks against the Malian army, and the Malian army was forbidden to go in that region.
Okay. So, Mr. Colmain, your final comments, we're running out of time, but now France has redeployed its military in a neighboring country. How does this play out?
Well, the frontiers between these countries are quite porous, and the deployment of French troops in neighboring countries always has an impact on neighboring conflicts. The French haven't finished operations in the Sahel. They're not going to relinquish power there. They see that Russian military technology is a game changer here. The Russians have been providing sophisticated intelligence reports to African governments, which is now basically turning against the French. Whether this will have a real impact in the United Nations is another question, due to the general hegemony of pro-US, pro-French, pro-British, pro-Israeli forces in international relations. Nonetheless, I think it is significant that this is another accusation being made by an African government against France. The previous accusations have been made by senior officials in other countries in Africa. For example, Cameroon a few years ago also accused France of supporting terrorist groups. And the French attempted to censor the media in that country. And they've been doing that in many other countries. So there really is, I would say, an uprising, an anti-European, anti-Western uprising taking place in Africa that is to the benefit of Russia. We're seeing, for example, demonstrations in various African countries in favor of Russia's position on the Ukraine war. People are increasing. The world is increasingly seeing the West for what it is, which is a defunct, has been military power that is in decline, civilization that is in decline. And there is a power shift, I think, a geopolitical power shift right now taking place in international relations towards the East. And this is all part of that process, I believe.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gerard O'Colmain, journalist and political analyst, and Mustafa Traoré, academic and political commentator, both from Paris. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Many thanks for tuning in.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, is to call for a ban on crippling energy price rises this autumn. and a move that would save the average household more than £2,000 a year on gas and electricity bills, The Observer can reveal. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Observer's political editor Toby Helm. The piece is titled, Keir Starmer Demands Ban on Raising Energy Prices. In Britain, the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, is to call for a ban on crippling energy price rises this autumn in a move that would save the average household more than £2,000 a year on gas and electricity bills, The Observer can reveal. The demand to freeze the energy price cap at the current £1,971 level, blocking the regulator Ofgem from allowing a huge anticipated rise to around £3,600 in October, will place intense pressure on the Tory leadership candidates, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, to follow suit when one becomes Prime Minister. Keir Starmer's plan, to be announced on Monday, comes as 70 of the country's biggest charities and organisations across health, mental health, education, care and other sectors today warned Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak in a joint letter of dire consequences throughout British society unless they take more drastic action to address the energy and the wider cost of living crises. Paul Kissack, the chief executive of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, which coordinated the letter, said the UK faces a national emergency while the government is asleep at the wheel. Demanding urgent help for the most vulnerable in the form of a doubling of the £1,200 that was committed earlier this year to households on means-tested benefits, Paul Kissack said, without it, vulnerable people will face a catastrophe on a vast scale when winter sets in. The consequences of sitting idly by are unthinkable. Labour leader Keir Starmer, who returned from holiday at the end of last week, has come under pressure to say more on energy prices after former Labour leader Gordon Brown made the running with a series of major interventions. In The Observer last weekend, Gordon Brown called for an emergency budget. He has also demanded the freezing of the price cap, as well as the temporary nationalisation of energy companies which refuse to offer lower bills. In a pointed remark, which some saw as a glancing reference to Keir Starmer, Gordon Brown wrote last week, "Time and tide wait for no one, neither do crises. They don't care holidays and politely hang fire." It is understood that Keir Starmer will call on the government to instruct Ofgem to freeze the cap on bills, saying it is within its power to do so. Senior sources said the choice for Labour had been between supporting huge amounts of extra cash help to the most vulnerable or preventing a massive autumn hike in energy prices happening at source. "It seemed best to stop the rise happening in the first place," said a senior insider. In response to rapidly rising wholesale prices, Ofgem warned in May that the cap would have to rise by around 40% to about £2,800 this October. Since then, forecasts have shot up, with analysts at Cornwall Insight last week predicting an increase of £3,582, more than 80% higher than the current limit. They also forecast further increases to £4,266 in the first quarter of 2023. New analysis for the Institute for Public Policy Research think tank, commissioned by the Economic Change Unit, finds that freezing the price cap would not only save families more than £2,000, but also help peg back inflation, preventing it from being embedded in the economy. The research says that if the cap were to be lifted to £3,600 as predicted, inflation would soar to around 13%. But if it were frozen at £1,917, inflation would be held back at 9.2%. Sarah Jane Clifton, Executive Director of the Economic Change Unit, said it was time for the government to act and make energy companies pay. Other countries have held down prices to protect the financial security of citizens. There is absolutely no reason why our government can't do the same and shift the burden onto those profiteering from this crisis. The energy price cap, introduced in 2019, limits the maximum amount energy suppliers can charge for each unit of gas and electricity used. In their letter to Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, the 70 charities and other organisations, including the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, Age UK, Trussell Trust, Children's Society, the Trade Union Council, TUC, Shelter, Macmillan Cancer Support, Mind, Oxfam, Great Britain and Action for Children tell the Tory leadership candidates that the cost of living crisis on low-income households is the gravest issue that our country currently faces. They add, so far this year, nearly three-quarters of low-income households receiving universal credit or other means-tested benefits, many of them working families, have been forced to go without at least one essential. This means people having to skip meals or not being able to heat their homes properly. Many of our organisations work directly with these families and are becoming overwhelmed, too often unable to provide the support which is so desperately needed. This situation cannot be allowed to continue. As the prospective leaders of this country, we urge you to act now to demonstrate the compassion and leadership needed to tackle this issue head-on. Isabel Hughes, Policy Engagement Manager at the Food Foundation, who also signed the letter, said, "Continuing price rises and the approach of winter will continue to make life harder for low-income families and those who have received proportionally less support so far are at particular risk. The government urgently needs to shield families from the worst impacts to protect children's health and their future." New polling for the Liberal Democrats, who also back a cap freeze, on Sunday, 14th of August, revealed that 7 out of 10 Tory voters back plans to cancel the October rise. The Liberal Democrat leader, Ed Davey, said the move should be funded through a tougher windfall tax on the energy giants making record profits. Labour said last night its plans to insulate more homes would save millions of British families more than £1,000. Ed Miliband, the Shadow Climate Change and Net Zero Secretary, said, "20 years of failure by the Conservatives to insulate our homes is one of the reasons bills are so high. Too many working people and pensioners live in drafty, cold homes with high heating costs. If they were serious about cutting bills, they could start right now by delivering the warm homes plan that the Labour Party has called for. A proper national mission would save 19 million families over £1,000 on bills and boost our energy security."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. Well, we have heard about the events of Karbala and women who had played important role in it. But there's a question that whether women before the moment of Karbala, were there women during the Karbala? We know that, but were there women post-Karbala and what was their role? We got to talk about all that in our studio with Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me today. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Siddiqa. Thank you so much for accepting the invitation. A very warm welcome.
Thank you.
To listeners, in our previous episode, we discussed about the role of women prior to the event of Karbala. But in this session, we're going to discuss about the women, their roles in the Karbala itself. I would want to ask you about the role of women in the Karbala itself.
So when Imam Hussein alayhi salam was traveling from Medina towards Karbala, he took his women and children with him. And there was a very important purpose for this, which we've discussed in one of the previous episodes.
Yeah.
But now he's in Karbala itself, and there are a group of women who might not have physically participated in the battle, but they had an important role in how they brought up the children, who then supported the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
All right.
Now, some of those women were just there in Karbala on the battle in the tents. We have a group of women who, the way they did the tarbiyah, this upbringing of the children, that these children then rose up to fight the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And we will see how these children were not adults. They were young children, but their hearts were filled with the love of the Ahlul Bayt. And love of the Ahlul Bayt does not just enter anyone's heart. This is a gift from Allah, but it is also the purity of the mother.
Yeah.
So one of those women I want to indicate to is the wife of Junad ibn Ka'ab. Her husband died in the battle with Imam Hussein.
Okay.
But she had a son who was around 9 or 11 years old. The son, 9 or 11 years old, goes to Imam Hussein. He says, let me go to the battle.
11 year old.
9 or 11.
All right.
History does not tell us what his exact age was.
Okay, so young.
Very young. Not even, he hasn't even reached that state of maturity as yet.
All right.
Imam Hussein tells him, look, your father's gone. Your mother might want you.
All right.
He says, my mother has prepared me for this battle. She made me wear this armor. She told me to go fight for you.
All right.
That's why I've come to you. And this is when this young child goes to the battle and gets killed. This mother has lost her husband. She has a son from this husband. But for her, the movement of Imam Hussein supporting the son of the Prophet, supporting the man who's standing up against every sort of falsehood is more important to her than her family.
All right.
And this is her
and
role.
Especially a son who's so young.
Very young.
Yeah.
That's one
so,
woman.
So that's quite interesting. I'd like to discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady. We're talking about the role of women in Karbala. So, Siddiqa, you were telling us about this woman who lost her husband and also her son, was quite young. According to some narrations, he was only 9 or maximum 11. And when he gets into the field of Karbala, Imam Hussein alayhi salam even tells him, go back, your mother might be in need of you. And still, he says that my mother has prepared me for this. I mean, this courage of women, where does this come from? I mean, this is something that takes away.
This is all comes down to the way we bring up our children. These women had the love of the Ahlul Bayt in their hearts. They grew up with this wilaya in their heart, and they understood that their responsibility as women, doesn't matter what race, gender, age you are, when it comes to wilaya, your responsibility is to protect the wali of Allah, to protect the imam, whatever your race, gender, age. And we see age, even 6-month-old child has fought in this battle.
Yeah.
But my focus over here would be his mother.
All right.
His mother was Rabab, right? We know that in Karbala there was a 6-month-old baby who was murdered, right?
Yeah.
Very brutally as well. But I want to focus on his mother. Imam Hussein is returning back to the tent with his own baby. His wife is Rabab.
Yeah.
Now the child has been killed. He has to take the child back to the tent.
All right.
From what narration tells us, Rabab goes back to the end of the tent. And there's a reason why. Now, you know, when your child dies, you want to go and take the child, you know, comfort them, you know, cry, weep.
Yeah.
She goes right to the back of the tent. The scholars have said she went to the back of the tent so that Imam Hussein does not feel embarrassed, even for a second, that her child was killed in his movement.
Oh, my God.
So this is not courage over here. This is cognizance. This is recognizing that if I have a responsibility to the wali of the imam, you know, usually when we do someone a favor, we want to go and throw it in the face.
Yes.
These women are showing us, no, we're not going to come and throw it in your face. We have a responsibility towards the imam of the time.
Yeah.
And if we fulfill our responsibility, it is a responsibility. We're not doing you any favor. Even though giving a child to a movement is one of the most heart-rendering things a woman can do.
A mother can do.
A mother can do.
That's at the same time heartbreaking, but at the same time, teaching a thousands of lessons with their just one reaction, with their just whatever they did. We're talking about the role of women in Karbala. We talked about Rabab, who lost her 6-month-old Ali Asghar alayhi salam in the Battle of Karbala, and how it feels like to lose a 6-month-old, only a mother can understand. Only a mother who has lost her son. I mean, there are mothers who lose their children. Like, it's not just nobody loses their children as young as 6-month-old. But so brutally being killed in a battle, we don't see it other than Karbala. Well, apart from Rabab and the ladies you mentioned before, who else played their role in Karbala?
So there are many of them. Like I mentioned, that Imam Hussein left from Mecca, from Medina with his women and children. Now you have some women who are part of his family, the Bani Hashim. And I'm going to leave their role, especially Hazrat Zainab, for later.
All
because
right.
her role is very extensive, extremely
True.
Extensive. There are books written about her.
True.
Right? I'm going to choose someone else whose husband was a companion of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
And I've chosen her specifically because she shows us that women, when it comes, we are also answerable to how we treat, how we react, and if we do not fulfill our responsibilities, how we should be ready for the consequences.
True.
So she was the wife of Ali ibn Mudahir.
Okay.
He was a companion of Imam Hussein alayhi salam who went to Karbala, who died in the battle.
Okay.
But the night before the battle, Imam Hussein gathers all his companions and tells them, I have removed my allegiance from you. Tomorrow these people, Yazid's army, after me. They're after my blood.
Yeah.
You don't have to fight. Right? You can leave.
Yeah.
They all go. You know, they raise their swords. They're like, we are here to fight for you. Even if we are cut up 70 times, brought back to life, and we are killed in the most brutal manner and brought back to life again, we will still support your cause because we believe in it. We know that you are on the right.
True.
So Imam Hussein tells them, look, the women are going to be captivated after this. You can send your women away.
Yeah.
Ali ibn Mudahir goes back to his tent, to his wife.
Okay.
And tells her, look, I'm going to fight for Imam Hussein tomorrow.
Yeah.
But you can go back. I'll send you to the Bani Asad. Bani Asad was a tribe that lived near Karbala.
All right.
And this wife had cousins over there.
Okay.
So he tells her, look, you go back, I'll send you there, and they will send you back home.
Yeah, you'll be safe.
Yeah. She looks at him and she says something very interesting. She tells him, on the day of judgment, you want to go in front of the prophet with a bright face, but you want me to face Hazrat Fatima embarrassed that I didn't support her daughters? Is that what you want me to do? She says, no, I will stay here and I will support the daughters of Hazrat Fatima through whatever difficulties they go through, and I will share their difficulties. And she says, and apparently it does seemingly seem that she went through all that captivity that they had.
Yeah.
And she became that source of comfort, help to this family.
All right. So not only she is supporting her husband in the event, she's also, when she's given a kind of safety, like she's given a kind of, you will be safe. She's given a guarantee of her safety. She again accepts to be captivated in supporting Imam Hussein alayhi salam's family. All these lessons, all these roles played by women teach us a lot. And especially I wonder over the basirat they had, not just in Niv, the Imam of their time, they also...
They recognized their role.
Recognize
the political situation of the time. They recognize the responsibility they have towards the Imam,
yeah,
and the responsibility they have to the Prophet, and the responsibility they have to Allah.
Exactly. Recognizing all those roles is not that easy. And then just recognizing them and just then working on them, it's again a tougher job. Inshallah, we'll discuss more about these events, more about the roles of women in our next session. For now, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. We now present you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled England Failing to Invest in Water Networks to Avoid Future Droughts. The UK's infrastructure chief has warned England is failing to invest in the water networks needed to avoid a future of recurrent serious droughts, with current policies amounting to the government keeping its fingers crossed. Sir John Armitt, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, said, with more hot dry spells interspersed with heavier rainfall, the current drought was a warning that water systems could not cope with the changing climate. He warned, investment is better than keeping your fingers crossed and relying on emergency measures. He said ministers could not prevent dry weather, but they could direct investment into infrastructure to cope with it, such as reservoirs and cutting wastage. Sir John Armitt added, the government should set out what degree of risk from drought they would see as reasonable for people to manage and expect. He warned water bills may have to increase to pay for the investment needed. Sir John Armitt told The Guardian in an interview, if you want greater resilience to drought, then you have to increase water bills or general taxation to pay for it. Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more, as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. In several areas in the drought-stricken south of England, people have been forced to queue in the street as their water systems failed. In the village of North End in Oxfordshire, people have been relying on tankers. In and around Guildford in Surrey, handouts of bottled water began at the weekend after a pump failure at Netley Mill Treatment Works. In Everton in Bedfordshire, an already unreliable supply has been further threatened by drought. Hydrologists have claimed these are isolated incidents and that measures such as standpipes, a vivid memory for some from the last most serious drought in 1976, were highly unlikely to be needed in the current drought, as water companies were more resilient and better prepared than they were nearly half a century ago. The National Infrastructure Commission has estimated the cost of overhauling the UK's water networks at £20 billion by 2050, considerably less than the £27 billion the government has earmarked for new roads this Parliament, which campaigners say are not needed. Sir John Armitt said this cost was dwarfed by the cost of drought. He warned, in increasingly frequent droughts, you'll probably have to spend twice that much on bottled water from the back of lorries. He said new reservoirs should be strongly considered, despite the difficulty of obtaining planning permission, particularly in the southeast of England. In an interview with The Guardian, he noted water metering was also likely to be needed to encourage people to cut their usage of water, but the government is not keen. Sir John Ahmed, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, called for a national debate on how to fund water improvements. The two Tory leadership candidates, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, have called for action but shied away from setting out clear proposals on investment. Sir John Ahmed asked, "You have to balance water investment. Do you put it back through people's bills or through general taxation?" adding, "You have to ensure poor people are not being penalised." He said the role of water companies should be scrutinised. He noted, "There has been criticism of water companies paying dividends to investors. That has to be an issue for governments and regulators to decide." He added, "You can argue that water companies have invested too little. Going forward, the real challenge is for government to say what level of performance the public should be entitled to expect." People could have a substantial impact on water usage by changing their behaviour, for instance, by not leaving taps running and running washing machines only on full loads. But Sir John Ahmed warned this would not be enough alone, and the government under a new Prime Minister would face uncomfortable choices over the investment needed for new reservoirs and new infrastructure. He said, "There is a cost of living crisis, especially with energy bills, and people don't want to hear about water bills going up too." He added, "But one way or another, we have to find a way to pay for this new infrastructure." Sir John Ahmed added, "Poorer households could be protected if the government stepped in to make the current billing systems fairer." England has experienced its driest July since 1911, with only about 10% of the average rainfall for the time of year in the south of England. The period since November has been the driest 8-month period in England since 1976. After a dry spell for almost 50 years, the United Kingdom is now being warned to expect flooding from thundery showers that will offer little relief from the drought. The flood alert follows days of extreme heat warnings and the official declaration of a drought after the longest 9-month dry spell since 1976. Meteorologists warned that downpours are the wrong kind of rain to tackle the drought and are more likely to lead to flash floods from water running off parched earth. The heat wave is forecast to break with a yellow warning for thunderstorms covering almost all of the United Kingdom, all of England and Wales, and most of southern and eastern England in the coming days. The Meteorological Office warned of torrential downpours and possible disruption in some spots, adding that homes and businesses could be flooded quickly and buildings damaged by floodwater. It also said power cuts were possible. The Environment Agency also warned that properties could flood and travel could be disrupted by surface water. John Curtin, the agency's Executive Director of Operations, tweeted that the United Kingdom was in that twilight zone of having both flood and drought warnings. He said heavy thundery rain on parched and hard ground would lead to rapid runoff and heightened flood risk in the coming days. But this will in no way correct weeks of dry weather, so most of England will remain in drought. Professor Hannah Cloak, an expert in hydrology at the University of Reading, said the forecast rain was unlikely to be long-lasting or widespread enough to make a big difference to some exceptionally low levels in reservoirs and rivers. Dan Stroud, a forecaster at the Meteorological Office, said, "We're coming to the end of an extended very hot spell, and the ground has been baked, so it's extremely dry. The weather is breaking down into a mixture of heavy and thundery showers." Dan Stroud added, and rain from really intense downpours will be unable to soak into the baked ground quickly. It's very difficult for the water to actually get in because it has to force the air out of the soil. So dry ground gets very quickly overwhelmed and we then get surface runoff. He added, "What we really need is a continuous period of light rain or drizzle just to gently re-wet the soil. Intense downpours are not exceptionally helpful. It's going to take a lot of rain over an extended period of time to actually recharge the aquifers and reservoirs." Dan Stroud added, "Almost anywhere was at risk of the impact of thundery downpours, but it was difficult to pinpoint exactly where." He said, "Scotland and Northern Ireland were most at risk. The risk develops initially across Wales and the southwest of England, and then more widely across England during the coming days." Rob Thompson, who conducted the demonstration, said, "Dry, parched ground doesn't let water in as effectively as already moist ground because the soil is resisting water entering. The water sits on the surface to run off down slopes or simply sit in a pool." Three water companies, Welsh Water, Southern Water and South East Water, have imposed hosepipe bans, while Yorkshire Water has announced that a ban will start on 26th of August, and Thames Water is planning one in the coming weeks.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.